Real Nerds is a proud partner of the Denver Podcast Network. In the shadow of the mountains,
we speak.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to this John of All Trades podcast promo. Each Wednesday, I bring you a brand new interview with someone fascinating and ask the question we all ask when we meet someone new. Hey, what do you do? It's fun, informative, and it's the 2017 Westward Reader's Choice Award winner for Best Denver Podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, and johnofalltrades.us.
Oh, hi, podcast listeners. There's many ways you can listen to the Real Nerds podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can also subscribe on Stitcher Radio. You want to send us a Twitter message? You can do that. It's so easy, at Real Nerds. Like us on Facebook, Real Nerds Podcast. You can visit our website, realnerdspodcast.com, where there'll be a lot of articles for you to not only read, but to listen to our previous shows. You can also call us, 720-6NERDS5. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Brian. No, this is my announcer voice, and you're listening to Real Nerds Podcast. Should I do this as my real self? Oh, shucky darn.
Hi, this is Brian Cummings. You're listening to Real Nerds Podcast.
Okay, do it straight. Hi, this is Brian Cummings, and actually, you are listening to Real Nerds Podcast. Send money and real estate.
Hey, everybody, here's an exciting Real Nerds interview that we did at Denver Comic Con 2018. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to another exciting interview live on Comic Con Floor 2018. I'm Ryan, I'm with Zach, and we have a special guest with us. Someone you might know his work in the special effects world in Hollywood, Ed Kramer. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be back.
Yeah, we were talking before. We can't remember if it was 2 years or 1 year ago. We just know that we have crossed paths before.
We have indeed.
Yes.
It's in your archive somewhere.
It is somewhere. Because, you know, you probably do a lot of these. Eventually, they start blending.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, did I do that? I think I have, and I don't remember when, but it's happened.
Oh, yeah. When you get my age, man, everything blends together.
So you worked at ILM for a while.
I worked at ILM for 12 years. I was there from 1994 through 2006, or as I like to say, from Jumanji through Pirates of the Caribbean 2.
And you had your hand on a couple big properties while there.
I did have my hand on them. My hand was never the guiding hand. I always had some amazingly talented visual effects supervisors who were working with George on Star Wars movies, and amazing visual effects supervisors in charge of every movie that I worked on. So I was never at the top of the food chain, but I was kind of firmly entrenched right there in the middle.
But that was probably a pretty interesting time, though, because movies started transitioning from, you can look at Jurassic Park, stop motion, to blending into CGI, which you helped kind of shepherd and make what it is today.
Right. Well, I got to work. I was very fortunate to be able to work on Jurassic Park 2. I started at ILM just after Jurassic Park had been in theaters. So it was amazing to, you know, all these people were the gods of computer graphics, and then they became my office mates.
That was the benchmark was Jurassic Park, because it changed movies.
Jurassic Park changed everything because, like you say, it was originally intended to be stop motion. And what most people don't realize is that initially they actually worked out some stop motion techniques. They built what's called a dinosaur input device, which was an animatronic maquette that could be posed and animated using stop motion, but then it would send signals to the computer so that the CGI dinosaur would actually move under the control of the stop-motion artist. It was a great idea, and the dinosaur input device is still on display in a plastic display case, or in a glass display case at ILM, but they abandoned that technology because it even though it was done with computer graphics, it still had that stop motion look to it, which was the whole point of trying to get away from and get into computer graphics. So eventually it was done all with keyframes and inverse kinematics.
Well, and then if your work on The Lost World, then, I mean, it advanced even so much further in that, because the dinosaurs even moved more realistically in that. And to build an animal that you don't know, how do you and your team make them look so lifelike?
Well, there's a lot of things that go into making something look real. There's the animation, because animators, you know, have to be really skilled at understanding motion. But there's also stuff that people don't understand, don't know about. There's rigging that goes on underneath the animation. So there are artists who put a skeletal structure inside the dinosaur or inside whatever creature you're working on, that the animators can use. They can use that as the control for doing their animation. And those guys are really unsung heroes of the process. And then there's also the modelers, the people who build the dinosaurs or the CGI models. Then there's the texture painters, or at ILM they were called view painters. And because view paint was the name of the system that was written many, many, many years ago, I think by Doug Smythe. And that was how they painted the textures on the dinosaurs. And then there's the people who do the lighting, because, you know, if the lighting doesn't look real, the dinosaurs are not going to look real. And there's the people that write the shaders that describe how the surface reacts to light. And then there's people like match movers who make sure that the computer scene matches what the real world camera saw. So they've got to match the lens, they've got to match the camera movement. And if there's even the tiniest bit of play, you're going to see the dinosaur's feet seem to slip a little bit on the floor. So there's a lot of unsung heroes behind the process of making these things look real.
And then, so if we transition, though, to Star Wars, where, so dinosaurs, we have an idea in our mind what they look like, how they could possibly move. Star Wars, you're creating stuff from, well, that droid moves that is that, and you need to make him work in the real world. Is that more challenging than a dinosaur because of the weight, or is it more fun because you're kind of free to mess around with them?
Well, you know, you're actually in an area that I wasn't the specialist for. I was a lighting artist, and I did compositing work, and I also did effects work, so dust and debris and things like that. I always thought that, you know, I got the animation. It was already done by the time the shot came to my desk. But I always thought those guys were you know, just awesome, because I would get the dinosaur and he would just be a wireframe object, right? Mm. But he's already moving convincingly and realistically because the animators had done such a fantastic job. People like Eric Armstrong. I could name about 20 or 30 amazing animators who worked on those dinosaurs.
But you do an important part, too, because you have to sell the whole thing.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So you can't just have, I mean, if a droid just rolls through like dirt and nothing pops up, then you know he's not there.
Yeah, that's what a technical director does, and that was officially my title, was a senior technical director, and then I moved into being a sequence supervisor. But the technical director is given a shot, and you're responsible for lighting the scene, lighting whatever the CGI is, and if the character moves in front of a reflective surface, you've got to generate reflections in that surface. If the character's standing on something, he's got to cast a shadow onto that thing. So we were really responsible for all of those little details that make the shot actually seem real. And every day, we would have a big meeting in the morning called dailies, where the visual effects supervisor and everybody working on a particular sequence would all sit together and pick every shot apart, bit by bit by bit. You know, it's looking great over in this corner, but over in this corner, I think the shadowing would be darker, and the angle of the shadow maybe needs some adjustment, and you know, there are so many tiny little details, and that's what was great about working at ILM was the visual effects supervisors there were just, you know, the most amazing. They had the best eyes of anybody in the world because they could look at something, and instead of going, you know, something doesn't look right about that, they would go, ah, I know exactly what isn't looking right, you know, and they would be able to. So I learned a tremendous amount about how to just look at a scene and see what's right, what's wrong. And that's what I do. I try to instill in my students now, because now I'm teaching computer graphics at the Art Institute of Colorado. And one of the main things that I do with my students is really try to teach them how to see.
You know, because it's so fascinating. One of my favorite documentaries on any DVD is in episode 2, and it's I forget how long. It's pretty long, but it's about trying to get Yoda to look right through shadows. And because that was the first time he was an all CG character, and I remember it was just this poor guy on a computer, and you know, George would come up and say something, and he'd have to change a little bit. Then someone else would come say something to him, and I'm pretty sure the whole documentary is just about the ears. And it was a 4-month process of him lighting them, moving them, texturing them, and I just felt so bad for like the guys that are behind the scene. Like, this is what they think they get it, and then some other guy comes, no, not right.
And well, that was as far as the animation of Yoda. I think you were seeing footage of Rob Coleman, because he's an amazing, amazing animator, and he was in charge of bringing Yoda to life. So he was probably one of those people that George was saying, make him do this, make him do that.
Yeah. It's so fascinating. But you're also responsible for a pretty iconic scene in The Mummy, the scarab scene.
Oh, yeah, my claim to fame. If I ever do get a tattoo, I'll probably tattoo one of those scarabs on my arm, try to make a big bulge out of it, too.
What went into that? Because it involved, I mean, how many thousands, millions of scarabs were in the shot?
Well, that depended on the particular shot. There were some scenes with a heck of a lot of scarabs. I couldn't give you an exact count at the time. I could have queried the computer and found out on any given frame how many scarabs are there right now. But, you know, we were in the, you know, tens of thousands
wow.
of scarabs, and probably up to 100,000 in some scenes.
Wow.
And those scarabs were done with a technology that was pretty new at the time called particle systems, where you could control points in space and give them things like gravity and fields that would make them move in random ways. But then you would give them rules saying, if a particle gets too close to another particle, just move away, so that the scarabs don't actually go through each other. In that whole movie, you can look and try to find scarabs that go through each other. You won't find them, because the algorithm that was controlling them was making sure of that.
And how long did that sequence take?
Well, I think we were working on the, you know, it's a process, and a lot of it goes on before you start getting plates back from production. So we probably put a good 3 or 4 months of R&D work before we started getting the actual shots, you know, the plates that were filmed on set without the scarabs in them. And that was to figure out, well, one, what do they look like? So, you know, we had art directors. I think Michael Jancy was working on that. And they were designing what the scarabs would look like. I think, and Alex Laurent was designing what the mummy himself would look like. So once the design is done, then you have to do the modeling. Then you have to do animating of the limbs, so that you've got a scarab skittering in place. And at that point, then I could take that animation of a scarab skittering in place and apply it to every particle in the scene. And another thing that I had to do was to write the shaders on the scarabs so that made them seem to be iridescent, you know, to reflect little bits of green and pink and blue
yeah.
light. You know, it's very subtle, but if you didn't have it, you wouldn't feel like they were bugs.
Yeah.
Right? And one of the hardest things in those scenes was lighting, because they were black bugs in a totally dark environment. And how the hell are you going to get them to show up at all? So that was one of the technical challenges. But to answer your question, you know, we worked on it on the R&D for a few months before we started getting plates. And then we were probably working on the different shots for about 6 months.
Wow. So have you ever gotten, obviously, the some stuff the actors are just reacting to, and you got a reaction from an actor to react to something on there, and it didn't work right, and you had to change what you were doing to make it match the actor?
Well, we had a situation that was a little like that on the rock monster that is in the movie Galaxy Quest. There were a number of things that we had to do after the fact. We knew how the rock monster was going to move because the animation artist Huck Wirtz created the movement of the rock monster, and but they actually shot those scenes during the day, and so they shot some of the scenes in the morning, some of the scenes in the afternoon, some of the scenes in the evening. And what happened was, when we got the plates back, the shots that had to cut together, one had the light coming from the left, the next one had the light coming from the right. And when we cut the entire scene together first with just the backgrounds without the rock monster, and so what we realized, sometimes we had to flip some of the frames. Sometimes we had to eliminate shots.
Wow.
Sometimes we had to create a new shot that would create the continuity. And a lot of it was just to match the lighting in the background that may have been shot at different times of the day when they were on set. So
wow.
you never think about that as being a potential dilemma, but that
played into it. And do they just, like, hand you the footage, like, you figure it out. We well, shot it. It's your job now.
No. You know, the visual effects supervisor is always on set. And you try to get it as close as possible. And so everybody's thinking about this, but then when you come back and cut the shot together, you know, they might have changed the edit.
Gotcha.
You know, and so now the shots that might have matched when you were planning them no longer match in reality, because these are the plates that you got. So there's always little things like that, but that's what animators do, and that's what the process is all about, is figuring out how to make the scene work, even if you've got, you know, strange things that come up like that.
What shot of yours that you've worked on are you the most proud of, that you can point to and say, that's my best work? And I guess if you had to pick, like, a highlight reel, that's the one you'd close with.
Wow. Well, the one I do close with on my highlight reel, I guess, is the one that I should... it's a movie called Deep Impact, where Morgan Freeman is president of the United States, and Tia Leone is a reporter, and Maximilian Schell is her dad. And at the very end of the movie, the buildup of the movie is that there's this asteroid or comet, actually, that's headed toward the Earth. They discover it, and they send, you know, a ship up to destroy the comet. And instead of destroying the comet, they cut it in half, and now there's two comets coming at the Earth. What I was asked to do was the final shot where the comet is destroyed seconds before it impacts the Earth. So what was funny about that is the director, Mimi Leder, so it was one of the few times I got to work with a female director, and I think she did a fantastic job, because the movie was mostly about the characters and only secondarily about the visual effects. Most of the visual effects come in the last 5 minutes of the movie. And so it's a wonderful movie, as opposed to Armageddon, which was a similar movie in theaters at the same time, which was, a Michael Bay action, 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 action. But Mimi was thoughtful, but one of the things that we had determined at the beginning of production was that she just didn't want that final shot to be about a big rock exploding in space. She wanted it to peel back in layers. She wanted this beautiful almost a beautiful explosion that had depth to it, but had sheets of dust peeling off in layers. And so we spent a long time working on that, and it was beautiful, and everybody loved it. But about 2 weeks before our final drop-dead deadline, she said, you know, it doesn't have the impact that it needs to have, and I think this shot does need to be a big rock exploding in space. So with 2 weeks before our drop-dead deadline, Joel Aaron, who was my supervisor on the shot, and I spent that time just totally reworking the shot to make it a big rock exploding in space, and a bunch of little rocks exploding when they hit the atmosphere of the Earth. So, but, you know, as far as things that I'm most proud of, there's also something that's not in a movie, but it introduces a lot of movies, because in 1993, I got to work, I was very, very lucky to work with Jeff Kleiser on the Columbia Pictures Lady with the Torch animation that comes before every movie from Columbia Pictures. And, you know, I didn't have a big part on it. I worked on the rays coming out of the torch at the beginning. And
well, it's where the shot starts.
It's where the shot starts. And, you know, developed the techniques for that. And Jeff and his partner, Diana Walczak, you know, worked on the Columbia Pictures the logo, the text, and the moving clouds, and, you know, just making it beautiful. But it's really cool to, you know, hardly a day goes by where I don't see that logo somewhere somehow.
No, that's
so
pretty
that's
awesome.
Pretty cool. It used to be a joke with me and my family whenever we would go see a movie and the Columbia Pictures logo would come on. I would go, I did that. And then it got to the point where my kids would go, we did that.
Or I'd be like, we know. We've heard it before.
Right.
But look how beautiful it glitters, and the shot starts there and pans down. No, that's a pretty iconic shot.
So that, you know, I can die tomorrow, and that will live forever. So, you know, there is something pretty cool about that.
Awesome. So what are you doing now? You're a teacher, like you mentioned, and besides working at the Art Institute, what else do you do?
I'm glad you asked that question. I think it was a setup.
It kind of is, but, you know.
My primary job right now is teaching at the Art Institute, and teaching all kinds of things having to do with computer graphics, lighting and materials and dynamic simulations and compositing and modeling, animating, rigging. So there's a lot of things in computer graphics that I teach, but I do have a passion, and I do have something else going on outside of school. I started out wanting to just write a memoir, and I worked with a book writing coach, and we developed it into, you know, she said, well, you could write a memoir and sell it to maybe 20 or 30 of your closest friends, or we could come up with a really interesting idea based on who you are and what your skills are and what your background is. And so we came up with this idea for a book, and now what I'm doing is I thought that the book idea is great, but what I really want to do is make a documentary.
Oh.
And the documentary is called The Wizards of Hollywood. And what it is, everybody knows all these iconic shots from Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
But whenever there's on the DVD, there's the bonus features, the making of, they only talk to the director or the actors. They never actually talk to the people who created the dinosaurs, who animated the dinosaurs, who did the texture painting for the dinosaurs. So what I'm getting is the backstory of some of the most famous shots in movie history by interviewing the actual artists who did those shots.
Awesome.
So, for instance, there's a shot in Terminator 2 that everybody knows where the Terminator turns inside out.
Yeah.
And so I spent a couple of hours interviewing John Burton Jr., the artist who did that shot, who actually turned the Terminator inside out. And he was talking about what James Cameron was asking for, and he was talking about what the tool set was like, and then he was talking about things that he put into that shot that no one notices. And now, you know, after you hear his interview about it, you look at that shot again and you go, oh my God, I see what he was talking about. And I never noticed that before. And I interviewed a woman named Ellen Poon, who did the shot at the end of Jurassic Park where the T-Rex is roaring in the rotunda,
yeah,
and the banner falls in front of him. So she was telling me about working on that banner.
Nice.
You know, so all these things that people remember, the Wizards of Hollywood is going to be the backstory. They're going to get to meet the artists and hear stories that they've never heard before about these shots that they've known in their unconscious minds for years.
Awesome. And how far along are you in the production? Are you still just conducting interviews right now?
I have a number of interviews in the can already. I just brought on a producer-director whose name is Wendy Borman. She has a number of documentary films out, including one that's in theaters right now called The Women of Weed, which is all about the women in the marijuana business here in Colorado.
Right on.
But she's going to be helping with this, with the Wizards of Hollywood production. Hopefully I'm going to be able to have her direct and produce this film. We're working on a sizzle reel right now that we've got our first fundraising event planned, and things are going right along. I'm hoping this time next year we're going to have a trailer to show at Comic-Con of the Wizards of Hollywood.
Awesome. Well, thanks for stopping by. Thanks for telling us about Wizards of Hollywood. Is there a place people can go right now to follow Wizards of Hollywood?
Yep, you can actually go to wizardsofhollywood.com to sign up for a newsletter to stay informed about what's going on. You can go to my YouTube site. I have a YouTube channel where every Thursday I post a short piece of computer graphics history with narration, kind of with a personal perspective. My YouTube channel, if you just Google or if you just search for Ed Kramer and CGI history, you'll find my YouTube channel. I'm at Instagram at @Kramer_wizard. So I'm out there. I don't do Facebook. I have problems with Facebook. I've had problems with Facebook for a long, long time conceptually, and you know they just proved proved valid. So you know it is really hard to be social and to not do Facebook. But you know I do have all these other ways that people
You're out
can
there.
Stay
you,
in
you
touch.
You have enough.
So right. Thank you for having
no,
me.
No, thank you for stopping by again. It's great catching up.
Excellent.
Thanks, Ed. Thank you.
Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to another fantastic interview at Denver Comic-Con 2018. We had an amazing time, and we look forward to seeing you again next year.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Real Nerds Podcast. Real Nerds Podcast is a production of Nebulous Visions Multimedia. Thank you to Sparks Mandrill and Plan 9 Studios for our kick-ass theme song. Also, if you're in the Denver area and you're looking for a cool place to see movies, we see them at the Alamo Draft House in Littleton and now also in Sloan's Lake. Thank you to Colorado Coins, Cards, and Comics for supplying us with all our comic needs, especially you, Andrew. You know who you are. And a big shout out to James's mom. I'm giving you an electronic hug that you can feel through the airwaves. Thanks for listening, and have a nice day.